your Bible, turn to Esther 5, and we're looking at a very interesting kind of shift in the story of Esther. For those of you who've been with us, we're going through the book of Esther, and we've seen this story about the rise of this woman, this Jewish woman named Hadassah, to royalty through God's sovereignty, through his providence, through these details that are happening. She goes from being a commoner to being queen. And it's a very important shift because God uses her in this new position to save the Jews. And it's a very important task for the moment. It's a very important task in all of scriptural history. Today, as we look at Esther 5, we're actually not going to talk a lot about the banquet. You know, that's really the major event that happens here is we have this banquet. Esther gathers up courage. She goes to the king, and the king accepts her, shows her grace, and she invites him to this banquet, and this feast is laid out for Haman and for the king, and that pushes the story along. So we're actually not going to deal with that a lot today. We'll address that in a future sermon, but I wanted to address this other issue that's going on, and the way that I'll introduce is this. A lot has happened this past week, and hopefully as a country, we pride ourselves on being a democracy. Very important every time, you know, elections come up that we remind ourselves that we are democratic in our nature. But I've heard people say this, and I think it's a really interesting analysis. They say that what's actually embedded more in us than being democratic is in a very practical sense, we might be democratic in the ways that we vote for things. Some scholars have argued that we're actually a meritocracy. You know, that when you actually look at society, what matters in our country is what you make of yourself, your accomplishments, the things that you do, the positions that you hold. And, you know, when you think about that, that makes a lot of sense. You know, in our culture, we care a lot about about accomplishments and very little about character, right? I mean, I see that all the time. You know, we're a society that doesn't care too much about what's on the inside. We care a lot about what's on the outside. And if you haven't really figured that out or worked that out, that's actually a very dangerous thing. The Bible actually presents life, it presents human living in the opposite way, that what matters in life isn't what's on the outside. What matters in life is what's on the inside. And so there is a little bit of a conflict there. I think that contrast that we see between the way that society looks at us and the way that God looks at us really comes to a head in Esther chapter 5. In Esther chapter 5, we actually get this really unique look, this view into Haman's life. And it's very penetrating. As we look at Haman, as we see him, I think we might see a lot of ourselves there too. And as we see him, God gives us a contrast. So here's what we're going to do for today. For today, we are going to look into Haman's life, and we are going to look at this issue of accomplishments versus character, inside versus outside. And essentially, we're going to break it down this way. First thing we're going to really look at is we're going to look at what Haman lives for, because all of this drives down deep into his heart. He's a man of accomplishments, he's a man of wealth, and it comes from his identity, it comes from the things that he cares about, it comes from the things that he's living for. So we're going to see first what he lives for. Second thing we're going to see is we're going to see what that does to him. When you decide that you're going to build your identity around those things, when you're going to live your life this way, what is it going to lead you to? And the third thing that we're going to see is we're going to see what will actually transform you into the person that you should be. Okay, so we're going to look at those three things. First, what Haman lived for, what he lived for. We're going to see, second, what it did to him. And third, we're going to see what actually should be transforming us. Okay? So we'll jump into the very first point. First thing we need to do is we need to see what Haman lives for. And again, the scriptures give us this really deep insight into Haman as a person. Much deeper than I think most people could go. What is true, though, is up until this point in the story, we know very little about Haman. We know that he's rich. You know, we're told that in no uncertain fashion. We know that he's smart. We can surmise that he's crafty. And the ways that we know that is he is essentially, in a span of a few chapters, essentially a few short years, he has negotiated the very complex politics of the palace. And he has risen very quickly through the ranks. He has gone from being someone in the beginning of the story that was not even seen to someone now in chapter 4, chapter 5, who is preeminent. He's gone from a position where we didn't know about him to now where he is one of the king's primary advisors. And, you know, when you think about that, there's a lot that goes into that. That's not just happenstance. We can make the assumption that he was a very ambitious man. And then again, to negotiate the corridors of the palace, he must have been very wise, very manipulative, very crafty in his dealings with people. And again, that tells us a whole bunch. Again, we're in the part of the story where Queen Esther has really gone through this struggle. Mordecai's come to her and said, but he sent a message to her and he said, Esther, a decree has gone out that all the Jews are to be exterminated. And essentially he pleads to her, says, you must do something. And at the tail end of chapter 4, she goes through this process. She says, well then, ask the people to pray and fast with me. Well, actually, she just says fast. She says, ask the people to fast. And when we open up chapter 5, she gathers the courage. She goes before the king, and the king shows her grace. He pardons her. If you remember, in what we've seen through the story, you could never go before the king without being called. It's a dangerous proposition. She actually has this very sly way in which she dresses up in a royal robe. She stands in a particular part of the palace where the king can see her, but she's not quite in the court. And the king kind of sees her and says, Esther, what are you doing out there? Come on in. You know, and it's this very sly way she comes in, and the king gives her the scepter. She comes and touches it, and then she makes her request. And it shows that she's very intelligent. She understands the ways of the kingdom too. But in her request, she says, here's what I want, king. I want you and Haman to come to a feast that I prepared for you. And they both come and they have a good time. We get to verse 9 in the story, and Haman is on cloud 9. You know, he's just been invited to this special feast. And if you kind of read what's going on, it is special. I mean, typically when the king would do things with people within the kingdom, it was always as close as advisors, it was with the nobles, this is only the king and Haman. And so, I mean, Haman's on cloud 9. I mean, he's just been invited to this special gathering, and he thinks he's on top of the world, and here's what happens. In verse 9, it says, Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Right? I mean, he comes out, he's beaming, he sees Mordecai, and Mordecai doesn't even recognize, doesn't even respond to him. And in his heart, he thinks, how dare he? Doesn't he realize who I am? Doesn't he realize the power that I have? And, you know, it's actually very, very interesting the way that's described. It says that when Mordecai sees him, it says he didn't rise or tremble, right? I mean, here's Haman, a powerful, not just an influential, but a powerful man. And here he walks by Mordecai. Mordecai doesn't even flinch. You know, that's insulting to Haman. You know, Haman burns with anger, and he gathers his close friends and his wife, and he begins to vent. And I want you to listen to this vent really carefully, because it reveals a lot about Haman. It says verse 10, if you notice, it says, nevertheless, Haman restrained himself, went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. Now listen to his rant. It says verse 11, and Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above all the officials and the servants of the king. Now, here's what's going on. Haman has just been honored in this unique way. He's on top of the world. Mordecai refuses to acknowledge it. He goes home furious. And essentially, in his heart, what Haman is saying, how dare he? How dare he? And then when he begins to say how, when he begins to describe it, essentially what he's doing is saying, these are all the reasons why Mordecai should respect me. These are all the reasons why I am somebody. These are all the reasons why he should tremble. And if you notice here, what he puts in that list is he puts first his riches. He says, how dare Mordecai? He should honor me because I am a rich, rich man. Then he lists his children. Now, in the ancient world, children were a sign of success. They were a sign of blessing. They were a sign of the God's favor on your life. So he said, look at my children. And then he goes on and he says, Mordecai should respect me. He should honor me because of my position. Look at what I've made of myself. Look at where I've gotten. Look at who I am. And also his privilege. In that really short rant, and again, in scripture, it's just a verse. It could have gone on for hours. And in a very short span of time, what we see is we see what Haman has built his life around. We see what Haman has placed all of his identity, all of his hopes, all of his aspirations in. He wasn't just a rich man. He wasn't just a powerful man. He wasn't just someone who had a unique position of privilege. What we see in Haman is, as he responds in anger, what we see that all these things which are good things have become ultimate things. In other words, Haman had come to define himself by those things. That essentially he thought he was valuable, he thought he was important, he thought he was worthwhile because he was rich, because of his position, because he was powerful. And you know, in a lot of ways, what that is that's exactly what we started with, this idea of meritocracy. You know, what we care about more than anything else is we care about accomplishments. We care about actions. We care about the outside and very little about the inside. And, you know, I think that's something that's, it's not unique to our culture, it's not unique to our time, but I think it is true. I mean, think about this for a second. When you get into a setting where you're meeting people for the first time, it could be here at church, it could be in other situations, it could be at work. One of the first things you do, typically not at work because we know, you know, what other people do for a living, but you meet someone at church, what's one of the first easy questions to ask? So what do you do for a living? And you know what's interesting is depending on how they answer, that immediately gives you this all these things that you attach to it. So for instance, if we're in a room together and you were to meet me for the first time and we shook hands, you said, so young, what do you do for a living? I said, well, I work in sanitation, right? Immediately you would have all these ideas about what that could possibly mean. You'd have all these ideas about who I am as a person, about my character, about my intelligence, about my, you know, my interests. You know, you would immediately piece all these things together. And it's only through extended relationship that you would actually either be able to affirm that or correct that. But the moment you find out what someone does, you immediately attach all of these things to them. And it's not just their intelligence. You even attach moral assignments to those things. And we do it all the time. You know, if you meet someone and they say, oh, I'm a doctor, ding, 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 you think of all these things, right? You meet someone else and they tell you they're a mechanic and ding, 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 you know, all these things come to mind. And the funny thing is, none of the stuff that come up into our minds first and foremost are character things. We think about maybe what type of house they live in, what type of car they drive. Maybe we attach, again, moral assignments to that, that if they're higher up, they're probably good people, smart people. You know, we think about the influence they have, those types of things. And you know, it's really interesting that, you know, that's how we work. That we do care, at least initially, we do care a lot more about what we see on the outside than what's truly on the inside. And so here we have this man who, on the outside, looks great. He's ambitious, he's smart, he's accomplished. And the problem isn't that he's smart, ambitious, accomplished. The problem is that he's placed all his hope, all his worth in those things. That's the problem. That to him, nothing else matters except those things. He defines himself by those things. You know, it's funny because, again, I think we do this all the time. I don't know if you remember high school that well. Some of you are in high school and you haven't hit the stage yet. But I think back, and high school was a really weird time. When you hit your freshman, sophomore year, you're kind of forced, at least my parents forced me to think about my high school transcript a lot. And you know, the transcript's a really funny thing. In some ways, you send this piece of paper off to these different schools. And in some ways, you try to have a transcript that proves or shows that you're different or that you're valuable. You know, that if this school takes you, then it's a good choice for them. So I remember, you know, I played certain sports, and my parents, you know, okay, make sure to put that on your transcript. And yeah, I said, okay, sports, I did that. There were some service projects that I felt like I should go to because I could put them on my transcript, right? Oh, okay, a key club. Okay, they're going to this. I could say, oh, yeah, I helped the homeless, or I did this. I felt, you know, and I remember my sophomore year, me and a couple friends of ours, I don't know why we decided to do this. Someone had brought it up. I think it was like the last week of school, all the clubs did their club pictures. We actually spent the day going from club picture to club picture to club picture to club picture just so we could write it down on our transcripts. And we were never part of them. We never, you know, never set foot in it. But, you know, if someone could, we say, here it is in the yearbook. I was a part of this. And you know, the funny thing is we don't grow out of that, do we? We're people who care about resumes. And we might not ask for people's, but we build them in our heads about them. I'll tell you very honestly, too, even in the working world, I have a horrible resume. You ever ask me for it? It's pitiful. You know, I went to seminary. I served in this church. I worked in this field. I served in church again. And it's just, it's pitiful. I have very few marketable skills. I have very few things I can do. But it matters. It matters to us. We meet people and immediately we start building the resume for them. We start putting all the pieces together. And for us, you know, when we meet people, we want them to know our resume. We might not tell them up front, but we want them to know eventually. If you're someone who has a higher degree, chances are you want them to know. You know, you might not be a doctor, but if you're a doctor, you want people to know. It matters. And you know, again, these are good things. But when you build your life and your identity around them, they become terrible things. You know, when all of a sudden you think that you are a valuable person, that you are an important person because of those things, it actually ends up doing something else to you. When you take inordinate pride in that resume, then you find yourself chasing after the things that you can put on that resume. And that becomes incredibly dangerous. If you think that what makes you valuable and important is money, then you spend your life chasing it. If you think that what makes you valuable and important is power, influence, position, then you chase after it. If you think what makes you important and valuable is fame, you chase after that. And you see, the pursuit of those things, pursuit of any of those things in and of themselves might not be bad, but when you define yourself by that, that's when the problem arises. That's when you end up destroying yourself. I'll even say, you know, in spiritual circles, we build spiritual resumes, don't we? You know, sometimes we do good things, we serve, we give, and in our minds that becomes a feather in our cap. And we compare ourselves to other people. They might not know we're comparing it, but we compare. And we know, because we keep score. But you see, here we see a man who's very ambitious, who lives for the outside, who thinks he's important because of the things that people can see on the outside. And that's one of the reasons why he's angry. Mordecai looks at him, and he doesn't see any of those things, does he? He doesn't look at Haman and say, there's a powerful man. Look at his position. Look at his money. Look at what he has. Look at what he's made of himself. Mordecai looks and says, you're not too hot. And it infuriates Haman, right? You know, it infuriates him. Let me show you what it does, though. It's not enough to simply say, here's what he was living for, we can be living for these things too. I need to show you that it does, when you live that way, it does something to you. When you live for the resume, when you live to find value and importance in those things, it does something to you. So the question is, what happens when I place my identity in some of these things? What happens when I find my value, importance, my worth in things like possessions, power, influence, fame, those types of things? Well, I give you the broad answer, and the broad answer is when you place your value, your importance, your worth in those outward things, eventually those pursuits, those things turn you into a fiend. They destroy you. And I'll show you how that works. They do transform you. They make you a different person, but they don't make you the person that you think it makes you. Chasing after power, possessions, chasing after privilege, chasing after pleasures, they don't make you into a better person. It actually transforms you into a much, 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 much worse person. If you go back to verse 9, Haman is on cloud 9, and he runs into Mordecai, and what happens? It says, Haman went out joyful and glad of heart, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. First thing I want you to notice in this kind of section is I want you to notice how flimsy his identity is. Right? Haman has built his identity on his position, his power, his riches, his place in the palace. Now think about this. He's coming back from a very unique situation. In his mind, he's just been invited by the king and queen to this, you know, to this feast, specifically by the queen. And in his mind, and he should think this way, in his mind it means that he is the most important person in the kingdom outside the king, right? The queen has invited the king and Haman. It's not all the nobles, it's not all the advisors, it's not, you know, all the people who work in this part of the palace. The queen has invited the king and Haman to go to this feast. So Haman thinks that he is the most important, the most valuable. He thinks that he is one of the most influential people in the entire kingdom. He walks by Mordecai, and Mordecai doesn't flinch, doesn't think that. And what happens? Weigh those two. The king and queen think that you're incredibly valuable. Person who sits under you thinks you're not very valuable. Which one do you believe? Well, he believed this one. If you notice, Haman's identity, because it is locked into his position and his power, it's flimsy. All it takes is one person to say, "Are you really a big deal?" And it's shaken. You notice that? And it's not even a higher up. It's not even like the king said, "You know what, Haman? You need to slow your roll. I mean, you're not all that." Right? This is someone who's under him. Someone under him says, "Haman, those things aren't important." And it crushes him. Right? I mean, it's flimsy. If you place your identity in any of these outward things, it's flimsy. People will come along who don't think it's important, and you'll go, "What's wrong with them? Why don't they recognize, why don't they see me this way?" And you'll be frazzled. Now, beyond that, you know, here Haman has put all his value, all of his identity in these things, and he is completely angered. You could make the case that that Haman should be able to brush that off and say, "That's not a big deal. Everyone else in the kingdom thinks that I'm a big deal. One guy doesn't, not a big deal." But he can't. You know, the reason why, again, is he's built his identity around this. Let me give you a smaller example, and I'll argue to the larger. Let's imagine that one of you came to me and you said, "Pastor Young, I have this great book. You know, I think you'd really love it if you read it. It's a great book. It's my favorite book I've ever read. You know, it has these characters, and you know, through it, it shows this gospel message, and it's very, you know, very covert way, and it's, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in it, and I think it'd be great for you to," and you just go on and on and on about it. And at the end of about 15 minutes of extolling this book, And when you finally kind of stop and take your breath, now what would it be like if I said, you know what, I've read that book and it's really stupid. And you know, I think you're kind of dumb for liking it. I mean, how would you feel? I mean, even though I'm a pastor, you probably want to punch me, right? You'd be crushed. And that's to some degree, I mean, you know, it's a book you love, but it's not for none of us in this room, it's not on our scale of most important things in our lives. How much more would you be crushed if there was something that you were actually building your life around? And if that was torn away, it would be even worse, wouldn't it? And you see, that's what's happening. What's happening is, here is Haman, and he says, these are the things that make me valuable. These are the things that make me important. This makes me somebody. And Mordecai invalidates all of it. Simply looks at him and says, you're stupid for thinking that that's important. And you know what happens to Haman? He is so angered. He's so furious that he says, he doesn't even wish it. He says, my life won't be right until he is dead. Listen to verses 13 and 14. Verse 13 says, yet all this is worth nothing to me. The riches, the position, the power, the influence, all these things that I see is right there that make me who I am. It says, all these things are nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made. If you notice, Haman thinks Mordecai is the worst person in the world, and yet the fact that he's built his identity on this and Mordecai's crushed that, Haman becomes an even worse person, doesn't he? He becomes a fiend. You could look at this and say, well, that's an extreme case. Haman's an evil person, and only evil people murder. No. Every single one of us are only a few steps away from murder. If you place your hope, your delight, your value, your importance in anything besides God, number one, it can be taken away. Unless your true hope, your true identity, your true value is placed in Jesus Christ, it can be taken away. And number two, if it is ever taken away, you will turn into a fiend. There is almost nothing that you would do to not have that happen. And you know, the only reason why you don't feel like this is impossible for you is because you've never gotten to that point. Jails are filled with people who have done something because they thought they were losing the thing that made them valuable and important, and they couldn't take it. For some of them, it was a relationship. For some of them, it was a substance. But you see, we're not that far away from that. If your value and importance, if your identity is in something else besides God, and it is threatened to be taken away, you will do almost anything to keep that from happening. You know, if your identity is in anything besides God, it'll ultimately destroy you. It will ultimately destroy you. And really, there are only, if you make money, power, fame, pleasures, your purpose, your meaning in life, there's only one of three results. Okay, there's only one of three ways it can go. You can choose any of those things. You could say, money is what makes me valuable, and you'll chase after it. You could say, my life is about fame. My life will only be worth living if I am known, if people can recognize me, then you'll live for that. If you say pleasure, any of these things, if you make any of those things your purpose, there's only three results. Number one, first result is you will never get it. And in never getting it, it will crush your soul. Not a very good result, right? Number two, you will get it and you will lose it. And if that happens, you will become angry and bitter, and that will destroy your soul. Number three, you will actually get it, and you will actually keep it. And do you know what happens in that case? That's best case scenario, right? If that happens, you'll realize it never was what you thought it was. You will be disillusioned, and that will crush your soul. You'll look for the next thing to say. I guess it wasn't this. What can I live for? You ever notice how that's kind of what happens to people who are really wealthy? You know, they get wealth, and all of a sudden they say, they pivot. They say, I guess it wasn't wealth. I'm going to use my money now to do good things in the world. Why did they make the pivot? Because money didn't do it for them. Money didn't fix what was wrong. If you never get it, you'll be crushed. If you get it and lose it, you'll be crushed. If you get it and hold on to it, you'll be crushed. No matter what happens, if your identity, if the center of your life is not God, is not Jesus Christ, it will destroy you. For some of you, it will destroy you slowly. For others of you, it will do it very quickly, but it will destroy you. So the third thing we have to ask is, what really transforms? What will really turn us into the people we are supposed to be? You know, what can we do so that we don't turn into a fiend, so that we're not destroyed? Let me show you Esther. And a lot of this comes from 4. We see it in the beginning of 5. But honestly, here's where we are. First 4 chapters of the book of Esther, Esther's a footnote, isn't she? She's not the first person we're introduced to. She's not the main character in the story up until this point. She's just kind of a side person. You know, the king is upset, so he throws this thing, and there's little Esther, right? Esther becomes queen, and even that doesn't seem to be a big deal, you know, because the story is about Mordecai. And what's interesting about Esther is traditionally scholars have universally hated Esther as a person, Esther as a character. And that's been universal. It's been liberal scholars, liberal feminist scholars have hated Esther. Traditional Jewish scholars have hated Esther. And it comes from these places. You know, for liberal feminist scholars, they look at Esther and they say, Esther is terrible. As a matter of fact, the person they would side with is, they would say that Vashti is actually a great example. If you notice in the story, Vashti is the one who stands up. She's the one who's courageous. She is the one who essentially goes against and challenges this male-dominated society. She's the one that when the king calls, she says, no, I will not go. And so, you know, these liberal scholars pointed out and they say, she is the one that we should emulate. Esther is terrible. Look at Esther. Esther is compliant. Esther is obedient. She does simply what all the male authority figures say. The king tells her to do this, she does it. Mordecai tells her to do this, she does that. You know, she even has a eunuch who tends to her. He tells her what to do, she does it. And, you know, all these feminist scholars say she's terrible. Matter of fact, if you look at her more carefully, she comes to her position through what? Her beauty and her sexual prowess. I mean, very honestly, that's why she's where she is. And so these liberal scholars say, we shouldn't look at her. We shouldn't pay attention to her. She's not important. We shouldn't build our lives like she did. She affirms all the old stereotypes. She affirms all that's wrong. She never really challenges or questions the system. She never upends it. She simply kind of works through it. And they have a lot of problems with Esther. Funny thing is, on the other side, the conservatives, especially the Jewish scholars, they hate Esther too. Why? Because Esther compromised her faith, didn't she? She slept with a Gentile. And then, you know, when she's in the palace, she hides her faith and she hides her family background. And sure, that came from someone else, but she does that. And because of that, she ends up living like a pagan. She can't follow the dietary laws, the clean laws. She can't follow a lot of the spiritual practice laws. And essentially, she's in this position, and yet no one knows that she's a believer. You know, if she were to stand up in chapter 4 and say, do you know what, everyone? I'm actually Jewish. Everyone would be, my gosh, we didn't have any idea of that. Esther, you've been queen for years, and we never knew that. And so Jewish scholars hate that. They hate the fact that, you know, here is a woman who is supposed to be a woman of deep spirituality. We're supposed to look positively at her because the book is about her, and yet there's nothing good about her. Matter of fact, you know, what they would say is they would say that Esther should have been like Daniel. Remember Daniel? He's in the same type of position, but what does he say? He says, I will not stop praying. The king can put out an edict, but I will still pray to the Lord my God, even if it means my death. And what happens? He gets thrown to the lions. You know, think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. What did they do? Same thing. They didn't compromise their faith. They're put in a situation where they're threatened, their lives are threatened, and they say, we will not back down. And they're thrown in the furnace. And so Jewish scholars look at Esther and go, why do we even have this book in the Bible? Esther isn't the type of person that we should emulate. She's weak. She's ineffectual. She doesn't stand up for the faith. But you know what? In chapter 5, something changes. In chapter 5, Esther goes from being passive to being active. And from this point on in the narrative, she drives the story till the very end. She's the reason why the story ends the way that it does. All of a sudden, from chapter 5 on, she goes from being diminutive to now being bold and courageous. She doesn't outwardly disobey. She doesn't rock the boat in those ways. But we see her courage. We see her boldness. She's willing to go before the king. And you know, there's actually a very subtle thing that you have to really track through in a literary way or in a linguistic way. The author has actually put this hint in for us. In the 10 chapters of the book of Esther, there are 15 times where he uses, where he calls Hadassah, where he calls Esther, Queen Esther. 14 of the 15 show up from chapter 5 on. See, what the author is doing, he's trying to tell us that she has finally become royalty in his eyes. That she has finally become the person that God has meant for her to be. So we have to ask this question, what changed? From chapter 4 to chapter 5, what changed? Well, this. Up until chapter 4, Mordecai asked her to do something, and she did it. He said, don't let anyone know that you're a Jew. Don't let on. Chapter 4, she asked the people to pray, she asked the people to fast. And she knows that she has a decision to make. She can stay in hiding, or she can, I'll use this term, come out of the closet, right? And what she does is she comes out of the closet. She through her actions and through the subsequent things that are happening, she makes a decision, and what she decides is that her identity is going to be in God. With God's people. And that changes everything. You know, the same girl who was scared and fearful, who didn't want to rock the boat at the end of chapter 4 because of this change, says, if I perish, I perish. Remember that? Something has changed. And you know what? When God is the center of your life, when you find your value, your worth, your importance in God, that has nothing to do with the outside. It has everything to do with the inside. And all of a sudden, if you find your value, if you find your importance, if you find your worth in the stuff on the inside, then you stop worrying about the outside. And you know, what it does is it transforms you. It doesn't just transform you in terms of how you see yourself. It transforms you in how you begin to see other people too. It doesn't turn you into a bitter person. It doesn't destroy you. It doesn't crush your soul. It turns you into a better person. You begin to look inside of you and you begin to be able to look inside of other people. And what I want to close with is this. Like, how does that happen in you? How do you go from being someone who cares about the resume, who cares about what's on the outside, to caring what's on the inside? I think chapter 5 gives us a hint. And if you look at verse 1, we find that hint. The very first words there are, on the third day. You know, it's interesting because we read that and we think it's a timestamp, right? Queen Esther asks Mordecai, she says, Mordecai, tell the people to pray for 3 days, or tell the people to fast for 3 days, and if I perish, I perish. Chapter 5 opens and says, on the third day. You know, the Old Testament actually uses that phrase, that specific phrase, on the third day, very few times. But every time it does, it's significant. Every time it's used, it's actually meant to draw us to Christ. Every single time. And so here, when we find out that on the third day, Esther did this, for you and I who know what Jesus has done for us, we are meant to see that the transformation that happened in Esther's life happens in our life through who? Through Jesus. You know, what we find here in verse 1 is not a timestamp, it's a spiritual landmark. And the spiritual landmark tells us what will change your life. What will turn you from someone who only cares about the outside, only about the appearances, only about accomplishments, only about money, only about power? What will turn you from someone who only cares about those things to now someone who only cares about what's inside? The only thing that will make you that, the only thing that will transform you in that way is when you see what Jesus has done for you. That Jesus has died in your place and on the third day was risen. And it's only when you come to believe that Jesus has died for you will you be transformed. Because what does that do? It turns you inside. It shows you what you are on the inside, no matter what you are on the outside. The gospel says, doesn't matter what you are on the inside, Jesus has come to fix you on the inside. The gospel says that the message of the gospel goes deep inside. And when you know that, then you begin to stop caring about the outside. You begin to see what's real, and you begin to live accordingly. And that's what transforms your life. You can't just simply say, you know what, I'm going to care more about what's on the inside of people. You cannot do that, and you will not do that with you or with other people until you realize that God has loved you from the inside out. That Jesus suffered, he died for you, and on the third day, he was risen for you. Let's pray together.